Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing the Democrats' social spending and climate bill, Tuesday's elections, and how the Republican victories in Virginia have shifted the narrative about the state of the Republican Party. Joining us are two guests. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the author of several bestsellers, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. Hi, John. Thanks so much for joining us again.
It's an honor to be with you, Rose, and with Zach.
Well, Zach Carter is a writer in residence with the Omidyar Network's Reimagining Capitalism Initiative. Zach spent 10 years as a senior reporter at HuffPost. He is the author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Hi, Zach. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
Well, I want to ask you both about the latest on the social spending and climate bill. We have been reporting on this for the last three or so months with many, many shows about the actual details of the bill. John, I've been following a couple congressional reporters. Manu Raju of CNN reports that moderates want more time. They want a CBO, Congressional Budget Office, analysis of what is now a $1.9 trillion bill over 10 years, but it could take until the week of Thanksgiving for that to happen. He's also tweeting that the House held a vote open on a motion to adjourn, but they're still meeting with Speaker Pelosi, saying that they really, really want a vote today. So what are you hearing, John?
Well, first off, you are the only show that has done steady coverage of what's in the actual measure. So that stands out. At this point, the overwhelming majority of Americans still don't know what's in Biden's proposal. And I would venture to say that a substantial number of members of Congress don't either. So we are in one of these classic chaotic moments, which there's not enough emphasis on the fact that why they're rushing is because they all want to take next week off, right? I mean, they could just not adjourn and stay there and work on it, but they all want to get something done today and then fly off and take some time away. And that's problematic because this is coming together very quickly. By the same token, you see a sort of classic moment playing out here. Nancy Pelosi, whether you like her or not, whether you agree with her or not, is one of the most effective speakers of the House in history. And she looked at those results on Tuesday, which we'll talk about in a moment, and said, this is it. We got to do something. We have to actually pass something. She's got a lot of pressure from the vast majority of members who say that. The moderates who are saying they want a CBO rating are, you know, I mean, look, this is something of an absurdity. They know this is a pricey bill. They know it's, you know, the basics, it's been analyzed and looked at, you know, in all sorts of ways. So it's simply a delaying tactic because they're not sure they want to spend as much. Now, why it all matters is Pelosi's got a 3, maybe 4 vote margin. That's, you know, she can't afford to lose anybody. And so she is doing what she's very, very good at, which is a desperate kind of last minute attempt to pull everybody together and make people, some people cast votes they don't want to vote or do. But at the end of the day, I think they're on very shaky ground here. I think their chances of getting it pulled off, if they do decide they've got to go take their vacation next week, it's looking slimmer at this moment. Although I'm always cautious about saying that because 2 minutes from now, they might actually sort something out.
Right. And according to, again, Capitol Hill reporters who are tweeting about all of this, the Senate is on recess for about 12 days. So there's also that.
Yeah.
We've also given a lot of context about this bill. Right now, it's at $1.9 trillion. Bernie Sanders wanted $6 trillion. It went down to $3.5, now at $1.9. And we just want to remind everyone that the Trump tax cuts cost about $2 trillion. So context is really important. And again, this $1.9 is over 10 years. Zach, what's your read on this bill based on what's happening right now in D.C.?
I have a hard time getting a read on this bill based on what's happening right now in D.C. I think you know, in terms of passage and timeline, I think there will be a real dogfight on the floor, whether that happens today or in a week. I don't know. I think I'm a little more optimistic than John. I think they will get something passed. I don't know if it'll be today, but I don't think it'll be too far along before they actually do. Although I think it will be ugly before then. I also think the changes to the bill that have been made since the I think pretty straightforwardly disastrous election results on Tuesday show that the party leadership is thinking pretty clearly about what the headwinds are facing the party and what they need to do, or at least what they can do to combat those headwinds. Passing legislation, failing to get a bill passed before that election, I think was a really, really bad mistake for the Democratic Party. It's particularly bad because what most people have seen, if they've seen anything from the party over the last 6 months, is the party fighting with itself. It's not just traditional bipartisan gridlock. All of the fighting has been between Joe Manchin and the rest of his party. They haven't seen much from Kyrsten Sinema, although she's been just as bad as Manchin because Sinema won't give interviews or explain her positions. Manchin will explain his, but doesn't have particularly good explanations. And I think this all just becomes a wash for most people. Democrats are bickering with each other. We'd like to see something happen. While the Republican Party has a really coherent message about what they think is wrong with the country. I happen to think the message is incorrect, but it's very coherent. It's very clear. And they ran on it in certainly in Virginia, but around the country as well. So Democrats just need to do something. They need to get serious about their economic agenda and they need to pass it. And if you look at what Pelosi did after those results, she added back in a benefit that Joe Manchin had previously insisted on stripping out. It's a paid leave program for all workers, but it's particularly targeting women after childbirth, making sure that people can take time off when they have a child. That's exactly the sort of provision that you would want to see back in this bill if you were worried about losing the sort of suburban moderates who Democrats performed so poorly with on Tuesday night. So I actually think in a lot of respects, the party leadership has got their act together, which is not something I've consistently said about party leadership over the past decade. I think it's just unfortunate that there's a handful of peacocks in the party who would rather preen and make a big show about procedural objections than actually get things done.
So in addition to family leave, they have also managed to put back a wildly popular provision that people have been wanting for decades, and that would allow the federal government to negotiate Medicare prices. So, John, I was pulling my hair out when I was watching the analysis of the Virginia race, because when you look at these social programs, whether it's family leave, negotiating Medicare prices, raising taxes on the ultra wealthy, I mean, these policies receive overwhelming support. Not one Republican supports this package. And yet the pundit class continually said the Democrats are clearly out of touch. Look what happened in Virginia, and the Republicans are going to run with this, even though not one Republican supports these overwhelmingly popular plans. So what gives on that, right, John?
Look, only this Democratic Party could have lost Virginia this time. I mean, they are uniquely skilled at screwing things up. And let's just put a couple things in place, which I know our media does not cover politics in America. It covers gossip. But if they did cover politics, they would note a couple of things. First off, the president of the United States, who's supposed to be in charge, a lot of people think it's a powerful position, announced a week ago Thursday that they had a framework to pass this thing. And, you know, all engines were on, ready to go. In fact, things were so great, he was going to fly off to Europe and meet the Pope. And then what happened? They didn't pass anything. It stopped. It stalled out. Joe Manchin had another idea and then went and had a press conference on Monday talking about how bad the plan was. Just disastrous messaging out of Washington. But then also, I mean, understand the crisis of the Democratic Party at this point. They're running against, in Virginia, just to use this one example, they're running against the former CEO of the Carlyle Group, a guy who actually specializes in buyouts that cost people jobs, right? You know, I mean, this is this is sort of Mitt Romney on steroids. It should be one of the easiest people in the history of American politics to run against on a just simple, you know, progressive populist class-based message. And they couldn't get it together. Now, why couldn't they get it together? Because they, first off, they nominated a retread candidate, you know, Terry McAuliffe, who former governor, when they should have, they desperately needed somebody fresh and new. But secondly, they kind of like they got lost in the minutia of the moment rather than looking up at the reality of what they had to do. And I think that's a problem in Washington. I think it's also a problem in the states. And it is compounded by the media coverage, because the media coverage sort of reinforces this minutia rather than a focus on, you know, a big picture that might actually work. Bottom line is, though, you can't deny the fact that the imagery, which, of course, is what media deals in, the imagery of last week was disastrous. You know, again, the president announcing a framework when they didn't have it together and then flying off to Europe for things that I think are great. I think it's great to meet with the Pope. I think it's fabulous that they're doing the climate work. But it translated terribly. And my sense is, I would go so far as to say that if they had a genuine plan and passed it last week, gotten it together, had the urgency last week that they seem to have this week, I think there's a very good chance Terry McAuliffe might well have won, and that things probably wouldn't have been as bad in a number of other places.
Can you give us a sense, John, because I didn't pay much attention at all to local media in Virginia. Mm-hmm. Did you pay attention to that? Can you give us any insights? I mean, what is the that's the other thing that I feel is missing, is the media landscape has changed so much, even over the last 5 years. What is the media landscape like in Virginia? Do you know?
Disastrous. Disastrous. Okay. Right? It's, look, the media landscape in America is a disaster, right? I've covered elections in Virginia going back for decades. And, it used to be that you could go around that state, and in every region of the state, you could pick up a pretty good quality daily newspaper. Some were a little more liberal, some a little more conservative. Lots of strong weekly newspapers. Media in the state was relatively diverse, TV, et cetera. Now, because so much of the population in Virginia is in the D.C. suburbs, people are getting their information from out-of-state newspaper. The Washington Post is from Washington. It comes into Virginia, and they actually do a pretty good job of covering. But, most of their information is coming off TV, and it's coming from TV stations that begin with news from other than Virginia, and then sort of fade in some Virginia stuff along the way, and then a ton of ads, right, the campaign ads. So there's a disastrous media landscape, as there are in most states. And what happened was, we have this thing of media in general, which they got really excited about covering the debate about critical race theory and the debate about schools. And that's a, that's a reality, and you shouldn't neglect it. Glenn Youngkin weaponized that debate in a very dishonest way, but a very effective way. And so you have to cover it. But the notion that there was, sort of quality coverage of this campaign, no, there was not. There was sort of reflexive coverage of Glenn Youngkin, what he was doing. People, I think a lot of media actually quite excited about, this suburban dad candidacy. And then a tremendous amount of coverage of the fumbling Terry McAuliffe campaign, where he actually said things that genuinely did him harm.
Zach, we'll talk about your piece in The Atlantic about education in Virginia in a minute, but you paid close attention to the coverage ahead of these elections. What really stood out for you?
Well, I think John is right that the Washington Post plays a really outsized role in the way that Virginians interpret political reality. It's just the paper of record for Northern Virginia. As much as I respect the New York Times, everybody in Northern Virginia has a subscription to the Washington Post who follows politics anyway. And I frankly think the Post did a pretty good and responsible job covering this election. I'm a lot more critical of the Post's coverage of the Biden administration. I think most of their coverage of the Build Back Better package and the entire economic agenda that Biden has put forward has been kind of reflexively budget hawkish in a way that is kind of intellectually outdated. And just created the impression that Biden is doing these huge, sweeping, crazy, expensive things, which were like, you know, making sure that like increasing the child tax credit by like, you know, $1,000 a year. And you didn't get, I frankly think their economic coverage has been really alarmist. And so you kind of take the good with the bad there, with the post coverage. It's not, you know, the way that particularly in Northern Virginia people vote is often tied to local issues like education. It's also often tied to the national mood because Virginians, especially in Northern Virginia, are very politically aware and active. They understand the national narratives very closely because it's, you know, politics is is the city's business. And so I think, you know, to some extent, you can say the bad coverage that Biden's been getting in the Post hurt him in this election. But I don't think any of these problems for Terry McAuliffe were insurmountable. And I think, you know, you have to expect some critical coverage when you're in politics. You know, that's what happens. So as John says, you know, if they passed a bill the week before the election, I don't think we'd be sitting here talking about what a disaster it was. It would have been a bad election. I think McAuliffe would have lost at least 7 or 8 points off of what Biden did in just last year. But Biden won by 10. And in fact, you know, McAuliffe lost 12. So he lost the race. I think the Democrats have very, very serious problems here in the suburbs in particular. And I think those suburban problems are going to translate to other cities and other states. But I don't think they're insurmountable. I think there's an awful lot the party could do about it. They've just spent the last 6 months fighting with each other instead of doing things.
Zach, let's talk about the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic called The Democratic Unraveling Began with Schools. You write that you grew up in Northern Virginia and attended Northern Virginia public schools, and you were back there from March 2020 until this September. You write, anecdotally, you've never heard so much anti-teacher sentiment in the region as you did during the pandemic.
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. You know, Northern Virginia is a pretty diverse place. In a lot of ways, it's kind of like the Democratic Party establishment's like vision of utopia. It is, it's full of upwardly mobile, affluent, multiracial liberals. And it's been trending that direction on all of those fronts for the last 25 years. In a certain respect, I think the Northern Virginia model for politics is what the party has been pursuing in other states, because it has worked well in Virginia for the party. You know, 20 years ago, Democrats did not have a senator from Virginia, and they only had 3 of the 11 House seats. Now, today, they have 7 of those seats. They've got both of the senators, and they have only lost the governor's mansion for 4 years out of the last 20. So it is a, you know, it's a blue state. It's not really a swing state anymore. And if you can do that in other places, regardless of what your policy preferences and ideological predilections are, that would be an impressive thing from a partisan perspective. The trouble is, to maintain that kind of advantage, you've got to cater to those affluent, upwardly mobile suburbanites. And you can either do that as a party by passing national legislation, which benefits these people, or you can do it by paying attention to their concerns at the local level. And the trouble this year for Democrats was that they didn't do anything at the national level. So local issues took over. And there was a one local issue in particular that had a lot of suburbanites very frustrated. And that was the school closures from this year and last year related to COVID. I don't want to be particularly critical on the fact that schools were closed, because I think it was difficult to make decisions in the moment during the pandemic. I think there were very good faith and very good, in many cases, very good reasons why schools should have been kept closed. But a lot of students in Northern Virginia went a full year without school, and it drove their parents crazy. Not just having them in the house, a lot of people were driven out of the workforce as a result of this. I think 3 million American women were driven out of the workforce over the course of the pandemic. So this was really disruptive, and parents who were particularly frustrated by it didn't see the political system responding. They saw teachers and teachers unions in particular arguing to keep schools closed longer. And for parents who didn't want to see that happen, that was really, really frustrating. And I think the Republican campaign did a really good job tapping into those frustrations. You see a lot of coverage about critical race theory and the sort of Republican freak out over how race is being taught in schools. And I don't think that was particularly effective in Northern Virginia. I think it probably did help in other parts of the country, just as a sort of, you know, rally the base, get conservatives whipped up and energized. But I think almost any issue could have served that purpose in off year election where Republicans had just lost the presidency. In the suburbs where things really changed direction, I think education ended up being a problem for Democrats because there were a lot of voters at the margin who were more skeptical about the political system's willingness to, you know, deal with their concerns in education, whatever those concerns might be. And education just became highlighted. Usually, education is a great issue for Democrats in Northern Virginia. People live there because they love the public schools. They want to see them well-funded. It's a really pro-teacher kind of environment. I never heard people criticizing teachers. I won't say never, but almost it was very rare to hear people talking about politics in Northern Virginia when I was growing up there and complaining about teachers and teachers unions. This past year, I just heard it all the time. You'd be hanging out at the fancy dog park and everybody was mad about teachers and school closures. Whether that's fair or not, the Democratic Party had to do something about it and it didn't. And I think that's the big takeaway from the race in Virginia. And I expect that there will be some carryover in other states because in general, the more liberal the area, the more cautious schools were about reopening, which means even a lot of liberal parents were getting pretty frustrated by the end of the closures.
John, what would you add on the education aspects of all of this?
Well, actually, I think Zach's analysis there was really good and really vital. On election day, I wasn't in Virginia. I was in Wisconsin. And I did something that is very, very rare for people that cover politics. And it's called reporting. And I actually went to a town where there was a recall effort, a suburb where there was an effort to recall four members of the local school board because some parents in the district thought the school was going overboard in teaching about diversity. It was teaching American history as it actually occurred, not in some sort of right-wing fantasy. And so it was a very classic conservative recall effort. And they talked a lot about critical race theory. It was in a traditionally Republican county in an area where Trump had done relatively well. And so this looked like, you know, here it is. You're going to have Northern Virginia critical race theory talk there. And I agree with Zach that there was a lot of other stuff going on. But here you had an actual test in Wisconsin in this school district. Tens of thousands of dollars came in. Conservatives from around the country got involved. It was all over talk radio. On election day, the four school board members who supported teaching diversity and teaching history as it actually occurs, and, actually, I guess would have been considered the liberals, were all reelected kept in office with more than 60% of the vote. And so the bottom line is that our media will look at what happened in Virginia. And frankly, a lot of politicians, Republicans and Democrats, will look at it and say, oh, wow. There's this huge thing. They won't. I know that the smart ones will read Zach's article in The Atlantic, but a lot of them won't go into that depth. And frankly, many of them won't notice that in actual school board races around the country where these issues were precisely put to the test in Wisconsin, Virginia, or Wisconsin, Connecticut, I believe Minnesota, the liberals won. And so bottom line is, I think we are about to enter into a period where there's a lot of Democrats and Republicans kind of, you know, desperately trying to develop agendas around education for 2022. If they listen to Zach, they'll do fine. The Democrats will do fine. If they don't listen to Zach, and if they get all freaked out by the media coverage and that, and they don't pay attention to what happened in these school board races, they could end up doing some really dumb stuff and buying into some of the Republican arguments, which I think would be foolish. And but again, if the operative word is foolish, don't be surprised if the Democrats do it.
I just want to ask you both in our final minutes about dog whistles and the role that racism played in this race. Paul Waldman has a piece at the Washington Post, "There Are No More Dog Whistles." Paul writes, "With Republican Glenn Youngkin successfully turning the Virginia campaign into a referendum on whether white students are being cruelly forced to think about racism, Terry McAuliffe is charging that Youngkin is deploying the dog whistle." He writes that the thing is, we don't need dog whistles anymore because Republicans want everyone to know what they mean. That's how they operate. They are not going back. And then the New Republic, Timothy Noah writes, "Guess what card Glenn Youngkin is playing? Toni Morrison, critical race theory, the Trumpy GOP gubernatorial candidate is trying to take Virginia back to the 1950s. I think this is really important to talk about, especially because people of color have to deal with this now on a daily basis. John, first off, what are your thoughts on this? And how should this be discussed in the media?
With a lot of detail. You know, I mean, it should be discussed, and it should be discussed in a very thorough way. Again, I went and covered this this recall effort over in Mequon, Thiensville, Wisconsin, and they beat back a right-wing effort there, you know, in a very swing area, by describing, you know, what's taught, why it's taught, why it needs to be taught, and making, again, the liberal argument for why teaching about diversity, teaching our history as it really is a good thing. But, you know, the problem with our media is the effort to get, it's media and politics, is to get an easy answer out of every election. What Zach did with his piece was give you a more complex description that I think gets much closer to the reality. What I've tried to do in some of my pieces the same way. One of the things that I would emphasize that I haven't seen mentioned, I wish was, that where Youngkin talked about critical race theory in Virginia, there's an assumption, oh, he's talking to the suburbs. He's really trying to reach the suburbs. No, the emphasis on that was trying to reach rural southwestern Virginia and Trump areas. This was an effort to mobilize the base, not to swing suburban voters. And if you understand it as such, yes, it wasn't a dog whistle. It was a dog, you know, yelp. It was very loud. It was very, very clear. But its intention was a base mobilization. For Democrats, a smart way to counter it isn't to try and echo what the Republicans are doing. It is to do more to mobilize their own base. That's the key, not to believe that somehow suburban voters are up for grabs on this particular issue.
And there's a good article by, I'm not sure if I'm getting his name right, Asted or Asted Herndon with the New York Times, mm-hmm. "Black voters in Virginia refuse to be blamed for a major Democratic defeat." It's a short but really interesting piece that's an important part of this conversation. Zach, what would you add to that before we end this segment?
Yeah, Sten's a great reporter. I think, you know, Paul Waldman's a great reporter, too. But I disagree with his analysis here. I don't think that the race did turn into a referendum on critical race theory and the role of race in schools. I think what John just said was right. That was a dog howl to the base outside of suburbia. And I think the people who showed up in Youngkin's ads, like this wealthy woman in Fairfax County trying to get Toni Morrison's beloved band from Fairfax County, I don't think the voters who, you know, those voters who switched from Biden to Youngkin were doing so because they were freaked out about Toni Morrison being taught in AP English. I think that's a mistake and a misunderstanding of the Northern Virginia voter. I think there were other school concerns for those voters that were salient in this election because Democrats failed to make any other issues salient. I mean, we haven't really talked about how bad the McAuliffe campaign was, but you just can't run against Donald Trump, which he did consistently the entire campaign, when Donald Trump is not in office. I mean, that is pretty basic malpractice. And it shows you how kind of out of touch, out of ideas, a lot of people in Democratic leadership can be. But that said, you know, the solution to this is really straightforward. To the extent that there are things that can be solved here. Democrats just need to pass some legislation and start providing some public goods to people. And they have a bill to do that with some really great stuff in it that certainly people, voters in the suburbs of Northern Virginia would appreciate. I mean, the childcare portion of Build Back Better is a direct shot at the kinds of concerns that were salient in this race. It's a no-brainer, but as John said, if anybody can screw this up, it's the Democratic Party in 2021.
Mm. Well, and I just want to ask one more question, John, if you can just give us a quick overview in a minute. So much attention was on the Virginia races, but so many other things happened on Tuesday. What are some of the highlights for you that are not getting much attention?
Well, one of my highlights is, and it's very appropriate to this show, because we talk about media. If all of the counting was done before they announced the results of elections, we would have a very, very different analysis of what happened on Tuesday night. Hmm. Because in New Jersey, on Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, it looked like the Democratic governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, might lose. In fact, when all the votes are counted in New Jersey, he will have won with roughly the same percentage of the vote that Glenn Youngkin won with in Virginia. And his margin will be relatively similar. And so that's not a landslide. It's not a great showing for a Democrat. As Zach said before, it wasn't a good night for Democrats. But it wasn't the disaster that it looked like in that, kind of urgent, high-pressure evening. So that's one thing I really emphasize. Another thing I'll emphasize is that if you look around the country, you're going to see a real mix of results, not one clear result. Boston elected Michelle Wu, who is a very progressive Democrat, very associated with Elizabeth Warren. And she ran on Green New Deal, on support for diversity, on an embrace of a very future-oriented vision for how to reform policing and a whole bunch of other things. And similarly, in Austin, Texas, they beat a proposal to expand the police force and do all sorts of things that you would think, if you read some of the top-line analysis, is where everybody's at. So you had a mix of results. But you also had results out of Minneapolis, where they did defeat a referendum to reform policing. And so the best way to look at what happened on Tuesday is to take a deep breath and look across the whole country, look at the reality of where it stands a couple days out, not just on the night, and accept that, we are coming off of COVID-19. We are coming off an incredibly destabilizing and challenging moment in our history. And it is not surprising that you're going to have volatile results. That's just a simple reality. And so I wish, and I'm very romantic about this, I acknowledge it totally, I wish that we did the journalism that we did even 20 years ago. Not that it was better in every sense. It was disastrous in its coverage of foreign policy. I've written books on that. But on the basic coverage of politics, if you had a really thorough, kind of slightly slower coverage, I think people would be a little less freaked out right now. But with that said, all of that long answer to a short question, it was still a pretty bad night for Democrats. And it does reflect a reality that if they don't learn to govern in Washington in 2022, they're going to end up dealing with some of the same problems.
Hmm. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books, including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. And if you want to learn more about the book, we had John on the show. You can just search for it at yourcallradio.org. As always, John, thanks for your great analysis and thank you for joining us.
It's always an honor to be with you. And it's been great to be with Zach today.
Zach Carter is a writer in residence with the Omidyar Network's Reimagining Capitalism Initiative. Zach spent 10 years as a senior reporter at HuffPost, and he is the author of a book we still need to highlight. We'd love to have you back, Zach.
Sure.
The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a real treat to be on with John.
Thank you. And you can find their latest articles at yourcallradio.org. And since we were talking about COVID, we also wanted to mark the tragedy that we got the word yesterday that 750,000 people have died from COVID in the United States. And we'll definitely do another COVID show in the coming weeks. Coming up after a break, we will talk about what has been accomplished at the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.